This is case 79 from the Blokhlev record. Tutsus all sounds. The pointer. When his great function manifests before you, it doesn't keep to patterns and rules. He captures you alive without exerting superfluous effort. But say, who has ever acted this way? To test, I'm citing this old case. Look. The case. The monk asked Tutsu, all sounds are the sounds of the Buddha, right or wrong? Tutsu said, right. The monk said, teacher, doesn't your asshole make farting sounds? Tutsu then hit him. Again, the monk asked, coarse words or subtle talk all return to the primary meaning, right or wrong? Tutsu said, right. The monk said, can I call you an ass, teacher? Tutsu then hit him. The verse. Tutsu. The wheel of his ability is unobstructed. He releases one and gets two. The same for that and the same for this. How pitiful. Innumerable people playing in the tide. In the end, they fall into the tide and die. If they suddenly come to life, the 100 rivers would reverse their flow with a rushing, roaring noise. Koan study expand our understanding in multiple ways. It pushes us to show independence, go beyond intellectual interpretations, and present an experiential understanding that is not limited towards or silence. It also teaches us some of the history of Buddhism and the development of Zen tradition through stories and dialogue. But there's another important aspect that I personally find very helpful. It has to do with the personal and unique style of each teacher. Each one of them, each one of these masters, expounded the Dharma in a very unique personal way. When you read the biographies of these masters, you can see how they went from intense entanglements and doubts to great freedom and trust. We can read about how each one of them developed trust in their own personal expression and did not feel the need to emulate anyone in the way they taught others. And more importantly, it shows us that through diligent work and determination, a dormant potential can and will become your unique dance if you stay on it, on track. In this case, we meet Tutsu, whose teaching style was very direct and minimal. He lived in 9th century China and was a great-grandson of Huineng, the 6th patriarch of Zen. Now, the commentary describes him as plain and truthful. He had the eloquence which stood out from the crowd. Whenever a question was put to him, you saw his guts as soon as he opened his mouth. Without expending superfluous effort, he would immediately cut off the questioner's tongue. It could be said that setting his plans in motion from within his headquarters tent, he decided victory beyond 1,000 miles. Quite amazing ability. An amazing ability, but the question is, do we see that ability, or are we so blind, so trapped, that quickly we file that answer as, well, yeah, of course. I know that. And what do we do with that? Does it serve as an awakener for us? In this koan, the monk brings up a line from the Lankavatara Sutra, and he used it to get some teaching out of Tutsu, but also to push Tutsu's understanding. He says, all sounds are the sounds of the Buddha, right or wrong. And the answer was right. But what was Tutsu saying? Was that the answer to the question? Or was he cutting off the question? That's how we have to see that. In the footnote says, to that question says, this monk shows how to knows how to grab the tiger's whiskers. He doesn't notice the bad smell of his own shit. That's from the footnote. And the footnote to Tutsu's answer says, he's utterly swindling ordinary people. He sold his body to you. He has put it over to the side. Now what's going on in your mind? He has done his practice. He's clearly showing. But the question is, what's going on in your mind that brings up such questions? When you take such a simple statement as all sounds are the sounds of the Buddha, and then you try to look for hooks in that, you trap yourself. Obviously, you don't trap that which you're questioning, or the person you're questioning. The statement is free, Tutsu is free, the monk is not. We are not. And this monk wasn't satisfied. So he kept the game going. He asked, teacher, doesn't your asshole make farting sounds? And then Tutsu hit him. The answer itself has the power to even the unevenness and to settle the matter. But do we see that? Maybe it is so plain that we feel the need to put some flavor, to put our own flavoring in it. Add our own spices. Not willing yet to let go. Years ago, while teaching a class, an Aikido class, as an assistant instructor at another dojo, I came over to one of the students who were practicing on the mat and corrected his technique. And for some reason, it was important for him to explain why he was not doing the technique correctly. But as soon as he began to explain, I said in a very blunt and direct way, what you thought about this is irrelevant. Just do it this way now. And I walked away. At the time, I didn't think much about it, but many years later, I ran into this guy at a seminar, and he brought up this encounter. He said he was quite offended at that time. He wasn't used to such a direct approach. But he looked at it later, and he realized how beneficial that was to him. Not at that moment, because he needed to feel offended. But later on, he realized something moved. Or maybe something moved and then he realized that was valuable. Not sure. Doesn't matter. Direct approach. Direct, plain, simple. Personally, I grew up in a very direct environment where people, in Israel, where people are known to say it as it is, rather than beat around the bush. And I have great appreciation for this kind of communication. There's a false notion that to practice kindness means to sugarcoat words or wrap them in some kind of shiny Hallmark paper. And for us, being trapped in that notion, we end up catering to other people's feelings. And often, by doing that, we do more harm than good. We think we're doing something good, but we're not. It feels good at the moment, but it's not. When we are motivated by the fear of hurting other people's emotions, we lose touch with the heart of the matter, and thus have no clarity regarding what needs to be conveyed. The greater the concern about ruffling feathers, the more ambiguous the communication becomes, naturally. Because we're not concerned with that. This doesn't mean we shouldn't be courteous or considerate, nor does it mean we should behave in a crude way towards others. We just need to be not trapped by a belief that nice equals compassion. May come out of it sometimes. But sometimes being compassionate means or translate to something that may sound crude or harsh or direct. Sometimes the sword needs to cut to kill, and sometimes it gives life. It has to fit the occasion, not your emotions. The occasion has to fit like a glove. So don't concern yourself with being a good boy or a good girl. Highly overrated. Irrelevant. You may not. Zen is not interested in some image of being good. It will not let you occupy any position, good or bad, for too long. Diligent practice will quickly show you that you're fooling yourself and you're fooling others while you're fooling yourself. But diligent practice is essential. Last Sunday I mentioned the challenges of ongoing practice, inevitable difficulties we must face, and the fearlessness we need to embody when working through them. But how do we embody fearlessness? Does that mean we do not experience fear? Or does that mean we pretend we don't experience fear? And some of you know, about a week ago, Chiba Sensei, one of the legends in the Aikido world, passed away. He was a tough and demanding teacher. And this often happens with such teachers. Some loved him, some avoided him. I had the fortune to train under him periodically for a number of years. And personally, I feel deep gratitude for his teaching. But more so, I feel deep gratitude to the spirit he evoked in me while taking his classes. I've trained with many, many great teachers over the years, but never came across such palpable and intense spirit. Every one of his classes was highly charged, and every person on the mat was fully alert and aware of the surroundings and the issue of life and death as well. That issue went from conceptual to actual as soon as he stepped on the mat. And he would call me up for demonstrations occasionally, and I remember sitting there on the mat, vacillating between wanting to be called out and wanting to hide. The fear was real. But being fully present to experience it was not even an option. Everybody on the mat while he was teaching wasn't going anywhere with thoughts. Whatever thoughts were going on in each person's mind did not have more power that he presented. And kept everybody there. We work so hard to be present. And there it was. Everybody. What was amazing, what was to me, what was amazing about these experiences is that the fear coupled up with the physical demands of the training gave birth to a sense of fearlessness. The fear and the situation, the physical demands, gave birth to fearlessness. Fearlessness was not a feeling or something that I thought, well, I'd better practice. It was actual reality that just came out of the moment of being exposed to that, of taking the fear alone. So yeah, there was fear, absolutely. I remember one time at the seminar, He held me up in a choke while he was explaining the technique to everybody. And it was so tight that I started to faint, and some of my students were there at that seminar and they recalled that experience. They actually said that I started to loosen up. and I think at some point he realized that, so he let go just before I fainted. I mean, it wasn't malicious, he wasn't trying to, he was just explaining something, and the grip was so tight, they worked. This and other experiences I've had during his classes brought out a heightened level of awareness that carried over to other aspects of my life and changed it profoundly. It really did. I'm not saying you have to go get choked to wake up to anything. That's not the point. But the point is that we have to expose ourselves, willingly expose ourselves to difficult situations, to challenging situations, if you want to grow, if we want to grow. You know, to crack the shell, you have to heat up things, kind of like bringing out the purity of gold by exposing it to high heat. It won't be purified without it. You won't be purified without difficulties, challenges, without being pushed by a teacher. But by yourself, teacher cannot do it for you. The teacher will help you, not deny. And will remind you. But the work is yours, always. Intensity is an essential ingredient in forging a strong spirit. The founder of Aikido, Orsins, he said, the purpose of practice is to toughen the body, to polish the spirit, and to tighten the slack. This is very true in our Zen practice too. Growth rarely happens without difficulties, without challenges. We can relate to that slack in the way our minds wander to imagine lands while we sit, while we stand up, while we eat, while we work. And we can gauge how loose the slack is by the speed it takes us to snap back to reality. How long do we reside in those distant lands before we return? During Zazen, we hone the ability to identify that slack, and we refine our listening skills so we can hear the faint voice of the innate wisdom. It's there, and it is speaking. And from time to time, we need to be shaken up, whether it's by yourself or through the encounter with a teacher. We think that this monk got hit because he wasn't respectful. But is it possible that Tutsi was trying to hit the reset button? Ha! What does that do to you? Does it work? Does it snap you back? Maybe it does. But very quickly, the mind takes over. Very quickly, your thoughts become more interesting than reality. Doesn't take long. To some people, the way Zen teachers in China treated their students, their disciples, sound cruel, harsh. The same with the way Chiba Sensei was teaching. But what about all the self-inflicted pain we create daily? What about that? Isn't that cruel? Isn't that more cruel? Isn't that more harsh? When the earth under our feet shakes, it can crack the fortress we build. And maybe, maybe, the walls will come crashing down. Hopefully, they'll come crashing down. The second question in this case also brings up a line from the same sutra. Coarse words and subtle talk all return to the primary meaning, right or wrong. To say again, right. And the monk said, "Can I call you an ass, teacher?" Again, Tutsu hit him. And the footnote says, this monk just sees that the owl point is sharp. He doesn't see that the chisel edge is square. Limited seeing, limited understanding, thinking the teaching comes in one way. Well, how do we know? If we don't know, how do we know what is teaching and what is not teaching? We don't know. That's why there's teaching, because we don't know. We also don't know which method works and which method does not. We think we do. I'm going to go to where it's comfortable, to where they cradle me, to where they listen to me, to where I don't have to crank up the heat. I don't have to face, admit, work through, because it feels better, because everybody smiles all the time, but he hugs me all the time. In teaching, coarse words are used at the beginning when a student is unable to discern subtleties, and fine words are used when the student has advanced in the understanding and is more in tune with reality. But that statement can also be problematic if we think that we know what is coarse and what is fine. Many Aikido students perceive Jiba Sensei's teaching style as too rough, coarse, and abusive. And there may have been some truth to that. But there was also a great deal of refinement, depth, and a lot of heart in his style. During my limited exposure over the number of years I was exposed to him, I witnessed and experienced his tremendous kindness and gentleness, along with tremendous intensity and ferociousness. And somehow this concoction of fine and coarse have changed the course of my life. And honestly, I'm not sure if I'd be sitting here talking to you in this capacity without the exposure to this powerful spirit. Somehow it shattered something that needed to be shattered, that needed to be broken down, so I could free myself for myself. So I can be free to explore what I needed to explore at that time. That was years ago. But it still echoes in me. We have to remember all the time that the walls need to come down. The walls in the mind must be taken down if we are to experience freedom. Zen practice has one clear aim, and that is to awaken the practitioner to essential nature, and thus to the fullness of reality. The aim is clear, but the process, as it is often described, is like climbing a mountain of souls, sharp souls. If we are unable to pierce through the thick crust of delusion, we won't see anything. We truly need to triumph in the midst of life and death. In the midst of life and death. Not denying life, not denying death, not denying anything. Zweiti's verse says, Tutsu, Tutsu. He's saying his name twice. In awe for what he's saying, for the way he's teaching, for the clarity he's presenting. The wheel of his ability is unobstructed. We are obstructed. He is free. The same for this and the same for that. No matter where you go, no matter what you do, you will encounter pain, difficulties, challenges. Work through. Don't shy away, don't avoid. Muster up the courage to face. It's there, you have the courage. The fearlessness is in the heart of fear, not away from it. How pitiful. Innumerable people playing in the tide. This is what we do. Play with it. We ask questions. It's what the monk did. He took something so clear, so bright, so powerful, and he hung it around his neck. In the end, they fall into the tide and die. We fall into the tide and we die. And then he says, if they suddenly come to life, how wonderful would that be, huh? If they suddenly come to life, the 100 rivers would reverse their flow with a rushing, roaring noise. The whole earth will shake If you realize, if you realize, just you, everything will chirp and dance and be joyful with you at that moment of realization. Everything will be contained in that moment. Once a monk asked Tutsu, "What is Buddha?" Tutsu said, "Buddha." Again he asked, "What is the path?" Tutsu said, "The path." And then he said, "What is Zen?" Tutsu said, "Zen." Where do you go with that? Nowhere. What do you do with that? Nothing. It has the ability to wake you up. But we need a path, we need a teacher, and we need to be courageous. Bodhidharma talked about it in relation to awakening and teachers. He said, "All know the way, but few actually walk it. If you don't find a teacher soon, you will live this life in vain. It's true, you have the Buddha nature, but without the help of a teacher, you'll never know it. Only one person in a million becomes enlightened without teacher's help. Though by the conjunction of conditions, someone understands what the Buddha meant, that person doesn't need a teacher. Such a person has a natural awareness superior to anything taught. But unless you are so blessed, study hard, and by the means of instructions, you will understand." And Tutsu had that ability. With one word, one answer, clarity was conveyed. All walls came down. I want to finish with a short dialogue between Joshu, the great master Joshu, and Tutsu. Joshu said, he came to visit Tutsu. In his hermitage, he said, "Long have I heard of Tutsu, but since coming here, all I've seen is an old timer selling oil." Tutsu said, "You've only seen an old timer selling oil, but you haven't recognized Tutsu." And Joshua said, "Well, what is Tutsu?" Tutsu lifted up the jug of oil and yelled, "Oil! Oil!" Joshua asked, "What do you say about the one who undergoes the great death and thus attains life?" Tutsu said, "He can't make the journey at night. He must arrive at daylight." Joshu said, "I've long committed thievery, but you are a lot worse than me.